The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning. Were you from Cape Town? Why do I think that you were?
Well, I lived in Cape Town for a while. I wasn't actually from Cape Town. I grew up in Eastern Cape, but it was definitely Hartley Vale, definitely.
Hartley Vale. All right, there we go.
And I'm shocked that David Zim got it wrong. What happened?
I think it's the first time ever. probably his phone was hacked. It wasn't him. Time is 7:46. Anthony Reich, Israeli Air Force planes were in action last night attacking targets in Gaza after rockets were fired into Israel. Who was behind the rocket fire?
We're not really sure at this stage in terms of what's been divulged from the IDF spokesman. What we do know is that there was a code red siren last night, and that was then responded to by IDF planes, and then after that response there was a further code red siren. Both of the missiles that were fired towards Israel were actually ones that landed in open area ultimately, and there was no damage, there were no interceptions, no injuries, thank God for that. So at least, you know, that situation has kind of been at least calmed down, but the IDF did carry out its stated policy of no rocket fire without response. And what we've heard from the IDF is that they attacked a Hamas naval base, and they also attacked other Gaza, the other targets up and down the Gaza Strip following this rocket fire. Now, one of the speculations is that the rocket, the original rocket that was fired earlier yesterday evening, it was around 10 o'clock, was fired as a result of a link with Qatari money that was supposed to have come to Gaza today, another tranche of money from Qatar. And then there were rumors that the Israeli government had actually cancelled that Qatari envoy who was due to have come to Gaza today. And so the speculation is that the original rocket that was fired might well have been in response to those incorrect reports that the Qatari official had cancelled his visit. And, of course, then it kind of led to a round of rockets and retaliation against the retaliation. And so it went into a bit of a spiral with the second rocket being fired. And then again, and the Israeli IDF, the Air Force being in control of things and deciding to retaliate against the second rocket. As I understand things, the Qatari envoy is indeed due to visit Gaza today, carrying some more money. And there was a committee in Qatar that had approved the fact that each of 60,000 needy families will each receive $100. So that's what we know at the moment. And, of course, we'll be watching today to see what happens, both in terms of whether there's further rocket fire or not, which is more likely to be this evening rather than during the course of today. And also we will be watching to see whether that Qatari money is indeed approved and that Qatari envoy does make his way to Gaza to deliver that money. So, you know, we'll be watching carefully to see what happens over the next 24 hours. And, of course, this is all ahead of the usual Friday demonstrations along the border. If we believe what the Israeli intelligence services are telling us, then the truth is that it's not Hamas who's really behind these attacks, both on the border and in terms of the rocket fire, but rather other renegade groups around Gaza who are responsible for this. But once again, we'll have to just watch events over the next few days in order to determine exactly who's responsible and what will be happening.
Anthony, this means one of two things. It means either that Hamas doesn't have full control of these groups in Gaza, or it means, and we see this politically very, very often, that a group wants to maintain a certain image and therefore allows the Mavericks to do something that they can't do. So you see that, for example, you've seen it over the years with the ANC, that have the ANC Youth League, who would say outrageous things, and the ANC would say, you know, the youth of today, you know, let's pull them back in, it's wrong, etc., etc. But actually they've voiced something that that sector, or that more maybe perhaps aggressive part of the constituents would like to hear. Is there a chance, you know, what do you think this is about?
I think it's a little of each, to be honest. I think that there certainly are cases when these so-called renegade groups are operating with Hamas's full cooperation, but of course it's not coming from Hamas. So there's certainly an element of that involved. I think there are times, however, when Hamas is genuinely doing whatever they can in order to stop them from carrying out these attacks against Israel, in order to stop them from, you know, pushing people to try to breach the border, and Hamas simply fails to stop them. They manage to somehow get around Hamas, and it's very, very difficult for me to know at this stage whether these attacks last night were done with Hamas's tacit participation by just allowing them to carry on, or whether these attacks are ones that have been carried out while Hamas is really trying to stop them. From what we have understood from the security services statements recently, Hamas is genuinely trying to stop these attacks. But again, you know, that could change from day to day, and it's not clear exactly what last night's attacks were all about.
I certainly will keep an eye on that story. Vote sharing agreements have been signed amongst a number of the political parties. What is the significance of these vote sharing agreements?
Well, what I was going to say until, you know, these events took place over the last day or two is that we've really heard very little about the next election. All this, all of a sudden, seems to have gone very quiet. We're less than a month away from the election now, and one would expect that things are kind of ramping up. And in reality, that's not the case at all. And I suspect that some of that has to do with the summer holidays. But I'm sure that within the next week or two, we will be absolutely subjected to the usual pre-election shenanigans and you know, all the press, TV and adverts and things like that. But in the meantime, these vote sharing agreements have been signed. And the significance of the vote sharing agreement is all about the votes that are extra once the seats have been allocated. So for example, if a party needs, I'm just using numbers as an example, 1,000 seats in order to gain, 1,000 votes, I'm sorry, in order to gain a seat in the Knesset, and they happen to get 1,200 votes, effectively the extra 200 votes go to waste because they can't get another seat for those 200 votes. So what the parties do is they sign agreements to pool the extra votes together, to put them into a pot, and to then allocate, if that amounts to another seat, to allocate that seat to one of the two parties that have signed the vote sharing agreement. So typically it just means one extra seat for one party or another, because if there were more than one extra seat, obviously the party itself would get that seat from the votes that have been counted up. So it's a little confusing, and people have mistakenly understood this to mean that they're actually coming together in order to cooperate with each other in the election, and that's not the case at all. It's only all about these extra votes that would otherwise go to waste if they weren't pooled together in order to try and grab another seat for one of the parties that have entered into the agreement. So what we've seen is that, for example, the Labour Party and the Democratic Union have signed a vote-sharing agreement. We've seen that the Likud have signed Yamina, a vote-sharing agreement. And interestingly, we've seen that the Kahol Lavan group of Benny Gantz and Yair Lapid has signed a vote-sharing agreement with Avigdor Lieberman's Yisrael Beiteinu party, that is the one, yes, signed an agreement with them, which comes as a bit surprised because not only have they signed a voting agreement, but actually Lieberman has said that he would support Gantz for prime minister this time around. He would recommend him to be the prime minister when the president will call all of the parties who've got seats in the Knesset to ask who they would like to be the prime minister. Last time around, Lieberman recommended Benjamin Netanyahu. This time around, he has made it clear that he will recommend Benny Gantz. And as that's as part of the vote sharing agreement. So what's happened is that Kahol Levan have said whatever additional seats are left over, whatever, not seats, but votes are left over, we will pull together with Yisrael Beiteinu. And if that amounts to another seat, we will give it to Yisrael Beiteinu. Interestingly, and quite to the contrary of what one would have expected, the opinion polls have responded to this vote-sharing arrangement between Lieberman and the Benny Gantz Yair Lapid party by actually reducing support for Lieberman. And he's actually lost a seat as far as the opinion polls are concerned as a result of that vote-sharing agreement. And, of course, the Likud have jumped on the bandwagon and labeled Lieberman a left-winger, because he's now in the camp of Kahol Levan, who they labeled left-wingers. Of course, Lieberman has responded saying, nobody could be more right-wing than me. So if you're going to call me a left-winger, then obviously whatever you're saying can't have much justification or much truth to it, because, of course, Lieberman is very much regarded as on the very right of Israeli politics. So it's been interesting to see how these vote-sharing agreements have been entered into, and it's important to understand what the significance is. They might amount to nothing at all. In other words, if the extra votes pooled together are not enough for an extra seat, then, you know, nothing happens. It just lapses at that point, and there's absolutely no significance. And there's certainly no a meaningful cooperation between the parties as a result of this vote-sharing agreement.
Yeah, and finally, IDF forces fired accidentally yesterday on an Israeli crop-spraying plane after thinking that it was a foreign aircraft infiltrating Israeli airspace. Wow, how does a mistake like this actually happen?
Very, very surprising indeed, because one would think that, you know, all of the technology is really available for the IDF to be able to accurately identify anything that goes around in there. And, of course, the Israeli airspace is very, very carefully policed with air traffic control. There are particular zones that are labeled and, of course, altitudes that are allocated for different types of aircraft depending on what their purpose is. Just to give you an example, there's an area that's in the Yisrael Valley that is allocated in the early hours of the morning up to a certain altitude for the flying of hot air balloons. And it's very, very carefully monitored and very closely policed. And those hot air balloon operators who like to do that kind of thing, and that's quite a popular thing in Israel for people to go up in these hot air balloons, they are very pedantic about going up at a certain hour and being down by a certain hour and maintaining certain altitudes, because that's what the space that's been allocated to them by air traffic control. So this crop spraying plane, which the Israeli Air Force thought, and the IDF, the ground troops as well, thought was infiltrating from Syria, and was actually fired upon. They actually opened fire against this plane, although they didn't try to hit the plane as such, but they were kind of firing above the plane. So it's a miracle that nobody was injured or killed or anything like that in this incident. But ultimately, the plane landed. It was properly identified. And I guess that there's going to be quite a full investigation into this whole event to try to determine where the breakdown was, because there are actually a number of points at which this plane would have been identified, both by air traffic control and people on the ground and the Air Force themselves. So there would be a number of different places where the plane you would expect would be independently identified as to whether it represents a threat or not. But I guess what we're seeing here is a certain amount of nervousness that there is always the possibility of infiltrations. And of course, in the world of drones that we now live in and the UAVs, the unmanned aerial vehicles that we see all the time, of course, the Air Force and the air traffic controllers need to be very, very alert and very, very cautious about the possibility of aircraft infiltrating into Israeli airspace when it hasn't been authorized to do so. So there's certainly a little bit of nervous tension going on, and people opening fire against legitimate craft because of the fact that there's such a high risk of unlawful infiltration of Israeli airspace.
Yeah, I think that's the issue here, is just how jittery perhaps the IDF is at the moment on knowing that planes can come in from anywhere, and these incendiary balloons and all sorts of drones and things. So it's actually quite a sad reflection of that environment.
Absolutely. I mean, one would have thought that, you know, with the with the huge number of infiltrations that do occur into Israeli airspace, that the technology is there to accurately identify and to deal with them accordingly. On this occasion, it was incorrect, and fortunately, it didn't end in a disaster.
Yeah, absolutely. It is 8 o'clock. Anthony Reich, this is Where We Love and Leave You.